TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
The Birth of Israel and the Death of Zionism, Israeli Professor Ilan Pappe. Why the Zionist Project Embraced Settler Colonialism and Why It Will Fail to Achieve Its Goals. Here are excerpts from a much longer interview with the Israeli historian Ilan Pappe, first broadcast on the Middle East Eye channel on November 1, 2024. This program goes into distribution on November 5, 24, Election Day in the U.S., where support for Israel's bombing of Gaza has an outsized influence on the outcome. Thanks to Middle East Eye for the excerpts. They are a UK-based news website founded in 2014 and cover the Middle East and North Africa. Mohammed Hassan welcomed Ilan Pappe to their studios in London. Hassan is an Egyptian-New Zealander. He's both a poet and the head of video at Middle East Eye. Here's the quote from Ilan Pappe that he chose as lead into the conversation.
Palestine would be decolonized. That's a fact that people should understand. You can delay the disintegration of Israel. You can delay the decolonization, but you won't succeed in stopping it. It's, in fact, for the benefit of everyone, the Jews and the Palestinians. Having the right conversation instead of the wrong conversation is really what is important. And the two-state conversation is not the right conversation.
Welcome to the Big Picture Podcast. My name is Mohammed Hassan, and today it is my distinct pleasure to sit down with historian and professor Ilan Pappe. Ilan, welcome to the show.
Great to be on your show, Mohammed. Thank you for inviting me.
There are very few people that can stand shoulder to shoulder with you when it comes to the breadth and the detail with which you have documented the history of Israel and Palestine. You are prolific, to say the least. You're the author of more than, I don't know if you have a specific number in your...
24.
24 books. I mean, just this year alone, you published two books. Lobbying for Zionism on Both Sides of the Atlantic, and the latest, which is a very short history of the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I want to ask a provocative question to begin with, which is, you have spent the bulk of your career documenting this specific story. What is it that you're looking for? Is there something that you have been driven by to try and analyze what is happening in Israel and Palestine with this much detail, with this much veracity?
The main drive is to challenge fabrication and injustice, which go together in my mind. Namely, the way the history of Palestine is being still today taught, told, covered by the mainstream media, by the mainstream academia, by the mainstream political establishment, especially in the global north, but also in some parts of the global south, is a very important factor in the continued oppression of the Palestinians. And therefore, I do believe that challenging the dominant narrative of what happened 70 years ago and what happened a year ago is an important part of the struggle to help the Palestinian to regain what justly is their freedom, independence, and self-determination. That is my main motive. I really would like people to understand that it's easy to substantiate the Palestinian claims, to prove them through archival work, through professional work. And I hope that by establishing factual infrastructure for the Palestinian claim and history, more people would be persuaded that the struggle of the Palestinians is just and would support it. Because as we know, if you listen to mainstream media, let's say here in Britain, the historical version that they tell immunizes Israel, provides Israel an exceptional position by which it can perpetrate ethnic cleansing, and nowadays even genocide, and still be defined as a democratic state defending itself. And part of these descriptions are anchored in a certain historical version of what is Israel and who are the Palestinians.
And you outline your argument here, and you reiterate it at the end by saying that we need to change how we talk about Israel and Palestine, that there's no point talking about peace as if both sides are equally at fault, when the process we're really talking about is decolonization. How does looking at Israel through a colonial lens help us better understand its history?
Well, we actually look at Israel through the lens of settler colonialism, which is a version of colonialism. And if we understand well the concept of settler colonialism, we can even understand what motivates Israel today in its genocidal policies in Gaza. Settler colonialism is a movement of Europeans that were outcast, like the Jews, in Europe for whatever reasons, and Europe didn't want them. But they still wanted to be part of Europe, so they built a new Europe outside of Europe. But quite often they chose countries where someone else already lived in, the indigenous native population. And as the late great scholar of settler colonialism, Patrick Wolfe, says, at the moment these settlers encountered indigenous native population, a logic of the elimination of the native was enacted or activated. And this is also true about Zionism. There are some noble motives or impulses behind the idea of Zionism. Jews in Central and Eastern Europe were definitely facing a new surge of anti-Semitism in the 19th century that eventually led to the genocide of Jews in the 1930s and early 1940s. So this was a part of the genuine attempt by Jews everywhere in Europe to try and face an existential threat. But the moment they decided, and many of their allies, or those who became their allies for different reasons, decided that the best way to deal with anti-Semitism in Europe is to settle the Jews forcefully in Palestine at the expense of the Palestinians, Zionism became, from a project that meant to salvage Jews, became a settler colonial project. And that is very typical of settler colonial movements such as the ones that established the United States, that went through the genocide of the Native Americans before it created a modern Western democracy.
And I grew up in New Zealand, which is
another
colonial state that has its own story and has its own way of wanting to kind of reframe its past. And the common link, of course, is Britain. Britain, as well as the United States, like to see their role in Israel as a savior of Jewish, or persecuted European Jews. And the United States, since the creation of the State of Israel, has been one of its staunchest allies. And similarly, today we see the way in which American leaders talk about the United States, specifically people like Joe Biden, the president, as that this is a righteous cause, that Zionism is a righteous cause. What were those interests? Why was it that the early Jewish Zionist leaders found these allies in Britain and in the United States?
Yeah. Yes, the idea of a Jewish state served different interests. Some of these interests even contradicted each other, but they still shared a vision of a Jewish state as an asset that would serve them in the future. One important group was a particular stream within evangelical Christianity that actually were Zionists even before the Jews became Zionists. In the 17th century already developed these ideas. Some of the leaders developed these ideas. And the idea was that the return of the Jews, as they would call it, the return of the Jews to Palestine, or they would call it the restoration of the Jews to Palestine, was God's will and part of a divine scheme. They genuinely, of course, believed in it. We all respect faith and religious ideas. Among them, there were some powerful people who were senior politicians or important members of the judicial system in the United States, and also the financial elite. So that was one group that helped Zionism. The other group was a group of capitalists like the Rothschild family, who believed that because they were self-Jewish, that the Jewish projects, economic projects in Palestine, could benefit their businesses. A third group were British imperialists. We have to remember that Zionism emerges as an idea when Palestine is still part of the Ottoman Empire. Mm. So you can envisage a Jewish state in Palestine, but it's not under your control. And these British imperialists wanted very much Palestine and the rest of the Eastern Mediterranean to be part of the British Empire. So they also liked this idea. And the last group, which is a very interesting group in a way, of Anglo-Jewish aristocrats in Britain who were worried that the rise of anti-Semitism in Eastern and Central Europe would push Jews into Britain. Mm. Jews who were poor, who might have adhered to some more radical ideologies or revolutionary ideologies. And they joined forces with people like Lord Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary who granted the infamous declaration, by trying to divert the stream of Jews who understood that Russia was not a safe place, to make sure that they don't come to Britain and divert them to Palestine. Mm. So this was the early alliance. Of course, later on, the most important member of the alliance is the United States. Yeah. But that doesn't begin with the United States, we have to remember.
Mm. And even the United States during World War II tried to limit the amount of
exactly.
Jewish immigration.
Yeah, I think the U.S., many people don't realize it. The U.S., it is true that the United States supported the establishment of a Jewish state after the United Nations General Assembly petition resolution was adopted on the 29th of November 1947. And when Israel declared itself as a state on the 15th of May 1948, the United States recognized Israel. Mm. But they did it at the same time as the USSR, the Soviet Union, recognized Israel. It was much more to do with this Cold War politics. Mm. There were still a lot of important Americans between 1948, I would say until the late 1950s, who were not keen on the idea of a Jewish state. Mm. And they were quite important. That's why, of course, Israel and the Jewish community established very early on a very powerful and effective lobby. And since the death of President Kennedy, American policy towards Palestine and Israel was going only in one direction.
But you also highlight in 1948, interestingly, it was an election year in the United States. President Truman won that election, but beforehand, there was an attempt by the United States State Department to implement or at least suggest an international trusteeship over the mandate of Palestine. But then you said that there was influence, there was pressure from the nascent Israel lobby at the time.
Absolutely. The State Department was very logical. It claimed that the United Nations peace plan of partition produced war. And they were already aware that Israel began, or what would become Israel, began ethnically cleansing the Palestinians. So they suggested two things. One is to continue the negotiations, because they saw no logic on imposing a solution that the Palestinians don't accept. They said, so let's continue negotiating for another 5 years and find a solution that is also acceptable to the Palestinians, not only to the Jewish side. And secondly, which is very important, they produced a document in the State Department that envisaged a one democratic state for all, which is unthinkable if you think about America today, a one democratic state for all is the best solution for the question of Palestine. And it was, you're right, it was an election year, and the other candidate, Dewey, understood that this is a weak point in the administration, and he fully supported the idea of a Jewish state. And that, together with a very aggressive pressure on Truman, led him to retract or force the State Department to retract from an already declared American support for the ideas that I was talking about. Mm-hmm. If you read Harry Truman's autobiography, his description of how he was aggressively approached by the representative of the Jewish Zionist community in America, you can see how abhorred he was by that. But nonetheless, as a politician, he decided to go along with that.
It's quite a stark parallel with the moment that we find ourselves in, which is Absolutely. 2 weeks out from a U.S. election.
Absolutely.
In which the U.S. government seems unable to exert any kind of diplomatic massaging on the situation and on the Netanyahu government. And then, of course, you have Trump on the other side, who is lambasting Joe Yep. Biden and Kamala Harris for not going far enough in supporting Netanyahu and in supporting Israel. How did the situation in the United States get to where it is today, where the idea of, even the suggestion of a one state, as you mentioned, is completely out of the question?
Yeah. Well, I think the work of the lobby, as we know it, what we know it is AIPAC, but it had some earlier outfits with different names. I won't go into it. But they were in action since 1952, 1953. And that's a long time. And they perfected their activity as the years went by and really used very effective methods to make sure that American politicians on whatever level are loyal to Israel. And it took time to intimidate people, to make examples of those who objected or rejected AIPAC. I'm particularly thinking about, and that might give you a good answer to your question, I'm thinking about Biden. Biden is a young, his first appointment on Capitol Hill, I think it was in 1974, I might get the date, but early 1970s. And he serves on the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Senate. And the very powerful chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, Senator Fulbright, is just being exposed as very vulnerable due to the fact that he became enemy number one of AIPAC. Mm-hmm. And AIPAC succeeded in killing the political career of a person who, until that moment, was regarded one of the most powerful politicians in the United States. And they did it because he created a committee already in the early 1960s that looked into the activities of AIPAC as illegal, according to American law, by serving a foreign country and against what he thought was the American national interest. And they destroyed him. It took them probably more than 10, 12 years to do that. But I'm sure this impressed Biden. I have no doubt about it. So already the next generation, the post-Fulbright generation, say, if this has happened to Fulbright and I'm not Fulbright, I should be careful. Mm-hmm. And that becomes inertia. It becomes part of the DNA of an American politician to understand, as one of them, a less senior one, told me, she told me, I don't want to mention names, but she said to me, whenever I suggest even modest criticism of Israel, my friends and my staff reminds me that I'm embarking on a suicidal track, namely political suicidal mm-hmm. track. That's how deep is the fear, the intimidation. And you can see how AIPAC is working against candidates, especially African-American candidates today, who are not willing to support the Democratic Party line on Israel. They already succeeded in defeating some of them.
Yeah, Cori Bush.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the same tactics. The tactics, yes, we are not always have 100% success, but we have means to deal with those we fail to impress with our power, and we'll use more power to defeat them. In some cases, they didn't succeed, which is an indication that maybe some of the power is waning, given the fact that a lot of people in American civil society don't share the political elite's views on Palestine in this moment in time.
Why is it so tricky to speak, to write, to document the influence of the pro-Israel lobby on American politics?
Yeah. First of all, I want to say that the Israeli lobby works also with other lobbies. There's a very good book by an investigative journalist called Grant Smith that shows the connection between the tobacco lobby and the pro-Israeli lobby. You know, the pro-Israeli lobby can move politicians to vote in favor of the tobacco or arms lobby. I mean, there's a kind of dialectical relationship between these lobbies. They can serve each other's interests if they are powerful. So that's one reason they're so powerful.
And finally, Professor Ilan, we are living through a historic moment. And it's hard to predict what comes next, but it is definitely the most catastrophic moment for Palestinians and for Israelis since the beginning, since 1948. And out of this moment, you talk about the idea of decolonization. What are the first steps to that? Where do you see the situation going from the moment that it's in, which feels like it's the furthest place from a kind of resolution? Where is the first step to being able to heal from what the trauma of what has been experienced over the last 75 years?
I think we have to distinguish between two processes. One is already happening, and that's the beginning of the disintegration of Israel. Huge fundamental problems that I can't see Israel being able to solve, which can lead to all kinds of scenarios. Of course, I cannot know exactly how it will unfold, but knowing from history, there are various ways in which countries become failed states. And we have examples nearby, Syria, Libya, Yemen, Lebanon precariously getting there, and as well as Iraq is not over that danger either. So the disintegration of the state, that is usually a very violent process where the state loses control of large swaths of land, as happened to Syria. Israel is already finding it difficult to control the north, to control the West Bank. Of course, it will use the same methods it used in the Gaza Strip if it feels that it cannot do it, but it is also self-destruction. The implosion of the Jewish society from within, what we talked about, the lack of any common base between the secular and religious Jews, the growing international isolation of Israel, the distancing of Jews, especially young Jews, from Israel as an idea, from Zionism, the economic crisis that Israel is unable now to solve. It needs American help like never before. Also, the invincibility of the Israeli army is in question, given what happened. All these discrete processes can fuse together into a chaotic moment where the 500,000 of Israelis already left in 7th of October, the number would double or triple. So there could be this creation of a void. The second process is anyone there able to fill the void? Because if you don't fill the void, the chaos, as we can see in Syria.
Yeah.
I mean, this integration can take 30 years, 40 years, unless the National Palestinian Movement, the region, the international community comes and say, wait a minute, we have a different scenario here. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is not working. What is working? One democratic state, I don't know, bi-national state. At this moment in time, this is not the question. The question, as I said, is both the nature of the solution, but who is offering the solution. And the moment the region and the international community would willing to see the Palestinians as the people who determine the future in Palestine, in conversation with the Israeli Jews, no doubt. But they are moving them from being the secondary actor into the main actor.
From being the problem into the being the solution.
Into being the solution, exactly. Could turn the decolonization not just a process of deconstruction and destruction, but into construction. And we have to be wary of it, because look at decolonizations around the world. Quite often, what replaced the colonial regime was nothing to write home about. It was something that people felt is not what they were fighting for. Look at some countries in Africa, some countries in the Arab world. Mm-hmm. So a lot of us have great faith that Palestine would be different. That because it hasn't been yet decolonized, there's no Palestine state yet. We all hope that this would be a better model of success compared to many other projects of decolonization. I think that's why so many people pin their hopes about Palestine as being a beacon that would impact the area as a whole for how to rebuild the political structures in the Arab world that, in that part of the Arab world, Eastern Mediterranean, what we call in Arabic the Mashrek, that was built by the colonial powers after the First World War. So we are all hoping that from Palestine, the message of let's reshuffle, restructure politics and political institutions and outfits so that they respond better to the concerns and the needs of the people. There are too many hungry people in the Arab world, and this is a world that used to lead the world's civilization, gave the lead on everything. And I hope it will play such a role in the future.
Professor Ilan Pappe, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Huge thank you to our guest today, Professor Ilan Pappe. If you haven't checked out his work before, I highly suggest you do. The three books that I would recommend are The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, and the other two books that we mentioned during our conversation, Lobbying for Zionism on Both Sides of the Atlantic, and of course, A Very Short History of the Israeli-Palestine Conflict.
You heard excerpts from a 1 hour, 16-minute interview of the Israeli professor of history, Ilan Pappe. He's one of Israel's new historians. Since the release of British and Israeli government documents in the early 1980s, they have been rewriting the history of Israel's creation in 1948. Thanks to the Middle East Eye for the excerpts. Mohammed Hassan is the head of video at their UK office. The conversation was first broadcast on the Middle East Eye channel on November 1st, 2024. This radio program goes into distribution on Election Day in the US, November 5, a day where US support for Israel's bombing of Gaza has an outsized influence on the outcome. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.